Since March 2009, the Pharmacy Podcast has been developing content monthly, weekly, and daily for the business of pharmacy. With more than 25 different podcast channels, more than 1 million downloads, and 30-plus participating pharmacists, the Pharmacy Podcast Network is the global leader in podcasting for the pharmacy professional. Find all of our podcast channels by going to pharmacypodcast.com/shows.
Pharmacy Podcast Nation, this is a special message for pharmacy owners interested in providing more value to your patients while seeing consistently higher revenues and higher margins. I'm talking about the Pen Needle UltiGuard Safe Pack. The UltiGuard Safe Pack provides 100 premium pen needles and a sharps container all in one for the same copay for your patients as pen needles alone. With Pen Needle UltiGuard Safe Pack, you're doing more for your patients and more for your pharmacy's bottom line. Check it out for yourself. Go to UltiGuardSafePack.com/podcast. That's UltiGuardSafePack.com/podcast. And let us know what you think. And as always, thank you for listening to the Pharmacy Podcast. Podcast Nation, welcome back to the Pharmacy Podcast Network. This is the founder and publisher, Todd Ury. So excited we are celebrating our 11th year of content development for the profession of pharmacy. And I have come across some of the most forward-thinking, innovative pharmacists. We just got done kicking off a new series with Dr. Feudin on pain management. You definitely have to look up that one. I believe it's episode 989. Once again, pain management, and just Dr. Feudin, he just really is passionate about caring for patients through collaborative care with physicians and other pharmacists. But today we are continuing the medical cannabis debate. Joe Friedman with the Medical Podcast, one of my favorite pharmacists out there, really started concentrating on collecting some great information when he helped me launch the Medical Podcast. And we're going to continue to evolve that publication. But today is part two of the medical cannabis debate. And if you want to access part one, which we did back on January 3rd of 2020, just this year, episode 910, that will be accessible in the show notes. So just go back and listen to the amazing discussion and eye-opening discussion about the other side of the fence with Ms. Carla Lowe. She's founder of Citizens Against Legalizing Marijuana. But today, Joe returns to take us into part two. Joe Friedman, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Todd. Thank you very much. Great introduction.
Hey, thank you so much. And what I'm going to do is turn things over to you to introduce, and let's get some outlines and background summary on our guests. And then with that, I will chime back in towards the end. Take it away.
Very good. Very good. Thank you, Todd. Okay, so I'm Joe Friedman, pharmacist, owned and operated a very professional medical cannabis dispensary in Illinois called PDI Medical. And it's been just great from the standpoint of taking it to the next level and being a speaker and getting in front of groups of pharmacists nationally and, you know, and getting sort of a raise of hands about the need for pharmacists in this industry to promote the credibility and the professionalism of it and to really help patients receive the best possible care. So with that said, today on the show, we've got Joe Jeffries, who's another cannabis pharmacist. But Joe, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit more about you?
I appreciate that, Joe. I am a third generation pharmacist. I grew up in my father's pharmacy on Main Street in southeastern Ohio. After graduating from pharmacy school at Ohio Northern University, shortly thereafter became director of pharmacy for a food store chain in the same area. I did that for about 15 years, and the latter half of my career was the director of pharmacy for Critical Access Hospital in the same area. There I helped start a program called Addiction Services of Eastern Ohio, an outpatient treatment center for opiate addiction. We detox patients using five different medications to treat the various symptoms of opiate withdrawal. Once they became clean, We use naltrexone intramuscularly, or Vivitrol, it's called, to help patients continue their required counseling. I really enjoyed that period in my life. Since then, I've become pharmacy director for Pharmaceutical RX, which is a multi-state company that does dispensing, cultivation, and processing of medical marijuana. It may seem counterintuitive that I'm a medical marijuana advocate, but I strongly believe that pharmacists are best positioned to help patients navigate the many doses and routes of administration of cannabis. And having done this for over a year now, counseling hundreds of patients in the Ohio program, my beliefs have only been confirmed.
Great. Thank you, Joe. And Bradley Carlson, another cannabis pharmacist who has done some unique things in poison control and emergency medicine. Bradley.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Bradley Carlson. I'm a 2009 graduate of the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy, a residency-trained emergency medicine pharmacist. In fact, most of my pharmacy career has been in emergency medicine. Back in 2014, I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to help author and launch Leafline Labs, which is one of the two medical marijuana conglomerates here in the state of Minnesota. Was lucky enough to be one of the first pharmacists in the state to legally dispense medical cannabis to patients here in this beautiful state, and fortunate to consult with several hundreds of patients before I moved on to another opportunity out in Pennsylvania and became director of pharmacy for another medical cannabis outfit out there, Keystone Canna Remedies. Helped with some of the authoring of the application there, as well as the initial stage of the launch of their program, and was the first pharmacist to legally dispense medical cannabis in the state of Pennsylvania, and really doing a lot of great things for the patients that are out there with treatments that have been underserving a lot of patients. But since that time, I've moved back to the beautiful state of Minnesota, where I currently am a specialist in poison information for the Minnesota Poison Control System.
Very good. Thank you, Bradley. And we also have Mr. David Evans, an attorney. And David, I'll go ahead and let you go ahead and expand on who you are and what you're doing.
I'm the senior counsel to an organization by the name of Cannabis Industry Victims Educating Litigators, CIVEL, C-I-V-E-L. I'd suggest if you want to learn more about our positions, go on to our website, which is civil.org. Look on the information box and read the submissions that we made to the FDA about medical marijuana and all the problems that marijuana causes people in terms of their health. The goal of our organization is to bring litigation against the marijuana industry, and that would include pharmacies who are dispensing medical marijuana. It's our position that unless a drug has been approved by the FDA as being safe and effective, that it is medical fraud, it is medical malpractice to dispense it and use it in treatment. And I would think that pharmacists would want to support the FDA because they dispense so many FDA-approved drugs and would uphold the FDA medicine approval process, but apparently they're the two guests here do not when it comes to medical marijuana. There is no question that there is going to be a reckoning with marijuana, as there was with the tobacco industry and the opiate industry. The opiate industry got away with murder for years. There's now over 1,000 lawsuits against them, and we are in the beginning of that process now against marijuana, and particularly medical marijuana. There's several class action lawsuits that have been filed at the end of 2019 as a result of the FDA issuing warning letters to companies that were manufacturing and dispensing CBD and making a lot of false medical claims. If you look at the Ohio medical marijuana law, the FDA has cited a number of the conditions that are in the medical marijuana law in Ohio as being false medical claims that marijuana could be helpful to them. So I hate to be the skunk that I'm invited to this party, but I might actually be doing you a great service by advising you not to get involved in this because you're exposing yourself and your company to a lot of liability and your patients also. Just because the voters in the state or the legislature in the state decided that marijuana is medicine doesn't make it a medicine. And I'll be happy to discuss any of the technical aspects of this. I'm also a former research scientist with the New Jersey Department of Health, and I've written several law books that deal whole or in part with addiction law and drug policy.
Okay, well, thank you, David. You know, one of the questions that comes up, you mentioned that, unless it's FDA approved, it doesn't really hold any value. It's not medicine. But if you look at history, I mean, the FDA has approved a lot of drugs that have since been pulled from the market, i.e. mistakes. Darvon, to name one, Sylert, Accutane, vitamin E. So, the FDA is not always on top of what's the right product to have on the market. And the fact that cannabis has been around for 10,000 years and has never really resulted in an overdose death, there's proof there that there is some credibility to this product as medicine. And so what I want to ask you is, where does your data come from? Where does your information come from? And is it possible that you're mixing cannabis with other products or illicit products that might also be very dangerous?
No, I'm not mixing up anything at all. And you're right. The FDA has made mistakes. And with certain drug products. And what happens when the FDA makes a mistake? There is within the FDA an adverse reporting system where physicians and other people can report adverse effects of drugs. And that's how the FDA finds out about it and they make changes. There's nothing like that for medical marijuana. There's no requirement for reporting adverse events. And if the FDA is criticized on approving a drug, the basic criticism is you didn't research it enough before you released it to the public. How much research did the Ohio legislature or the people of Ohio, I forget whether you had your medical marijuana approved by a vote of the legislature or by an initiative, how much scientific research did the people do when they looked into all these conditions that they approved as marijuana as a medicine?
If I may push back on that, Dave, this is Joe from Ohio, and I should speak to that since I'm very familiar with the program. There is an adverse drug reporting component to the medical marijuana program in Ohio. There are reports that are sent in to a database, and those are tracked and monitored.
Well, that's great.
I'd like to also chime into that as well, Joe and Dave, because here in Minnesota, they actually made that a mandate of the legislation when the program went live, that any and all adverse reactions related to any of the products that were being dispensed in any of the dispensaries would be tracked and monitored very closely. In fact, there was a conglomeration between safety call as well as the Minnesota Poison Control System to become involved with certain types of adverse events related to the use of medication.
That's great that they did that, but that's not the case in most of the other states. California doesn't have it. Colorado doesn't have it as far as I know. But the basic issue is that, and first of all, are those adverse reports made public so people can evaluate them? Secondly, the science establishing marijuana as a medicine for these conditions is very weak and does not meet, FDA double-blind study, looking at thousands of people testing it. It just isn't there. And for example, Ohio approved for cancer. The FDA has come out very strongly on that issue regarding cancer, saying that it should not be used with cancer. There already are two approved FDA medicines, Chesimet and Marinol, that are artificial cannabinoids that can be used. So there's no reason for somebody to go to a dispensary and get products that have very unusual names associated with them that are very unmedical. For example, Mr. Jeffrey sells a product called Lemon Skunk, Miami Heat, Banana Hammock, Screaming Eagle, Wanna Sour gummies. These are all advertised milk chocolate bars, blood orange. All these names that I just can't imagine. It sounds like these are advertisements to stoners rather than people getting serious help with their conditions. Let's look at glaucoma that is approved under the law, and I hope you're not giving it to anybody that's got glaucoma. The American Glaucoma Society says that actually using marijuana can damage people's optic nerve because it causes inadequate blood supply to the optic nerve and can contribute to glaucoma damage. And I'm
let me push back a little bit on that, Dave. I mean, you did call me out there a little bit in talking about some of the names of the products. You did point out to the listeners that Ohio has approved the use of all forms of administration. It cannot be smoked. It can only be vaporized. And I just, wondered in your mind, what does FDA approval mean in your mind? What percentage effectiveness of the drug could that be? Is it 25% effective? Is it 50% effective? What constitutes?
Well, here's what you get with FDA approval. You get a package insert, okay, and the package insert goes to a whole list of things that were considered in approving this drug. And you learn about what you should not do with this drug and what you should do with this drug. Let's just take Epidiolex, which is a CBD product made from the plant, the only FDA-approved cannabinoid medicine actually made from the plant. And the CBD Epidiolex, which was set up for two rare seizure disorders in children, has been approved for that. And you learn from that CBD can cause anemia. CBD causes liver damage, and you have to have your liver enzymes monitored. Now, when you give CBD to one of your patients, do you tell them that?
Dave, let me ask you. You asked me a question. Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Which component of marijuana, you mentioned glaucoma. Which component of marijuana is appropriate for glaucoma use?
Well, the only thing that, first of all, I don't think any of it is, but I'm just quoting what the American Glaucoma Society says, and they say not to use it.
I tend to agree with you that marijuana is probably not the most appropriate treatment for glaucoma and to lower intraocular pressure because we have plenty of regular medications to treat glaucoma. But
Hang on just a minute,
and I'll finish my statement. THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, is the appropriate treatment for glaucoma. Cannabidiol, CBD, which most people deem as safe, actually can increase intraocular pressure in high doses. We talk to our patients about this all the time. I talk to optometrists. I talk to ophthalmologists. That's the point that we're trying to make to you, that pharmacists are the most appropriate healthcare professional to help put this advice out there for patients.
Tell me where it was established that THC is an effective treatment for glaucoma. In FDA quality studies that a pharmacist could rely on. I'd like to know what they are. I'm not aware of them. I'm only aware of
if you actually take a look at the Minnesota Department of Health's compendium of studies that they used in order to justify qualifying conditions, and this is something that's available on their website. There's an almost 100-page document or so that details several uses of and several trials of medication that is cannabinoid-based that justified the use of cannabis-based medications in certain
trials.
I'm
familiar with a lot of those trials. A lot of them were done on small populations. They were not done according to FDA standards. And the FDA has looked at this. They issued when marijuana was up for rescheduling a couple of years ago, the FDA focused a whole document on this, looking at all the studies. The World Health Organization has done the same thing. Random controlled studies, and they said that it is not a safe or effective medicine. Just because somebody does a study, and a lot of these studies are done just like what was done with opiates or tobacco, done at the behest of the industry. One effective study that was done by the state of California by their environmental division that said that marijuana smoke is immunosuppressive and causes cancer. And they looked at a bunch of studies in coming up with that decision. And, you know, do you warn your patients about all this? Do you warn them with CBD, for example, or marijuana, they can cross-react with other medications? CBD can cross-react with other seizure medications. Do you warn people about that? Do your state websites have all those warnings? What about pregnancy? I mean, they did a study in Colorado where they had a woman who pretended she was pregnant, talked to the marijuana dispensaries out there, and said she was in her first trimester of pregnancy. And what would they recommend? 66% of them recommended marijuana. Now, the FDA has clearly said, the Surgeon General has clearly said, don't use marijuana if you're pregnant. But yet you had the dispensaries out there, and who mans the dispensaries? Now, again, you got an argument that maybe it'd be better to have a pharmacist in there. But a lot of these people are just bud tenders and, you know, that are giving medical advice to people, not like a pharmacy would. I don't know. The dispensaries in Ohio require a pharmacist to give the advice to the person and tell them what to do? Or do you just leave it up to one of the staff?
Your tone's interesting there, Dave, but certainly with our company, we do require a pharmacist to speak to a patient, and we do talk to
all those different items
that you talked about in terms of drug interactions, okay, safety, in terms of what's appropriate in certain disease states. We do go over all that with our patients.
And, you know, guys, I think we can all agree that, you know, this is a very debatable topic. You know, I think, Dave, you know, you had mentioned at the beginning of this interview that, you know, you didn't believe that, you know, with or without a pharmacist is really going to make a difference. You know, you've got three people on the line that would disagree with you in a big way. And, you know, you talk about California. Kaiser Permanente did a study, a prospective study, where they took 70,000 males between the ages of 17 and 70. And the question was, does smoking marijuana cause lung cancer? And the first group, you know, didn't smoke anything. There was a couple of cases of lung cancer. The second group smoked marijuana and cigarettes, and there was a tenfold increase in lung cancer. The third group, marijuana alone, and there was no cases of lung cancer. Now, I'm not jumping up and down and saying, oh, well, you know, marijuana is, you know, protective to the lungs, and you're not going to get cancer if you smoke it. But, you know, there's a big distinction between smoking cigarettes and toking all day long versus taking a drag on a vaporization or a joint. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily cause lung cancer. The science is just not out there yet, but we can be assured that the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Well, I think that on the issue of cancer, it's been linked to testicular cancer. It's been linked to strokes among young people. It has, at least the state of California, is linked to several forms of...
And where are you getting this information from? If it's coming from the FDA...
Well, I'm getting it from the state of California. They issued a formal report on it. The FDA has also clearly stated in the warning letters that you are not to say that a non-FDA-approved drug cures cancer or deals with cancer. And, you know, if you go on our website, the study that was done in California was done by their hazard assessment branch of their environmental health hazard assessment. And they said that there, and looked at several studies, that there is evidence that marijuana smoke is genotoxic, immunosuppressive, and can alter endocrine function.
David, let me just interrupt you. I'm sorry. I mean, you can go on and on, but I think, you know, you're hanging your hat on the FDA, whether it's approved by the FDA or not. Eventually, cannabis is going to be taken off of Schedule 1, and that's going to change your tune, and it's going to change the tune of Carla Lowe, and it's going to change the tune of a lot of oppositionists, because it's relatively safe, and it does not cause the harms that you're speaking of. You know, you can cherry-pick data left and right and come up with whatever conclusions you want to. But I think the thing here is fair and balanced information that has science behind it, where it's showing that it's really not the scourge that the opposition is making it out to be.
Well, I think what has happened is that the marijuana industry as did the tobacco and the opiate industry, distorts the science, lies about the science. The FDA, the federal government in 2016, not that long ago, responded to a petition for rescheduling marijuana, and it was denied, and it was upheld by a court after looking at all the scientific evidence. It's all published. You can get the sites off of our website on that, or just go into DEA or FDA. The DEA, the FDA, HHS all wrote reports, looked at the scientific evidence. There's also an extensive report done for the World Health Organization by Dr. Bertha Madras at Harvard, who also testified in the rescheduling case, and they decided not to reschedule it because it is a danger. The U.S. Surgeon General has come out very strongly against it as medicine, and I quote him, there's no such thing as medical marijuana. And they've looked at the evidence, same thing, so is NIDA, so is SAMHSA. So we have met with the DEA, we've met with the FDA, they're not going to reschedule marijuana.
David, have you ever spent any time in a cannabis dispensary? Have you ever spent any time talking to patients that have benefited from cannabis as medicine?
I have for years spoken to them. We didn't. In fact, we did a undercover operation in a cannabis dispensary in New York, where we sent an undercover agent in. We first of all went to a pot doctor who was blatantly corrupt in recommending marijuana for this person. Told them that there were absolutely no side effects to it, and they're required under state law to take a course that discusses the side effects. And then went to the dispensary. We have the dispensary admitting, and it's all on tape, admitting that they were giving out fraudulent recommendations. They were giving marijuana to housewives who had difficulty dealing with their kids, declaring that they had post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, the average medical marijuana patient in Colorado, the state that we have some data on, is a 41-year-old male. The average medical marijuana patient in California is a 32-year-old male with a history of substance abuse. Hardly people that are older or, undergoing chemotherapy. And, if you look at the bodies that have looked at the evidence, they say that it's not a medicine.
Say, David, have you ever actually spent time in a medical cannabis dispensary that sees patients that are supervised by a medical professional like a pharmacist?
I was the one that did the undercover study in the dispensary in New York.
Well, that was that was one that you said that was legitimately handing out prescriptions inappropriately. How about a legitimate pharmacy?
This was legitimate pharmacy. This guy, the dispensaries in New York are required to have pharmacists. And we also have former dispensary employees who are on our team who have testified about what really goes on in these dispensaries. And that is all going to become public knowledge. And whether a pharmacist gives it out or not, if it hasn't been, and what is the pharmacist going to do? Come in and attack the FDA process when they give out FDA-approved drugs all the time? Does that mean that every other drug they've given out that's been approved by the FDA is potentially fraudulent because the FDA doesn't do their job? Is that really the position that pharmacists want to take against
We're not really going to challenge the FDA. All I'm going to say is that the FDA still regards cannabis as Schedule I and illegal. And so the attention since the 1930s has been on the bad effects of cannabis and not on the beneficial effects. And so there's going to be a change in the paradigm here in order to show that this is beneficial. There's patents that the U.S. government had on CBD 20 years ago that showed the neuroprotective and anti-inflammatory properties of CBD. So you've got a government that's talking out of both sides of their face. And, you know, to go ahead and hang your hat on just what the FDA says is okay or not okay, I think is wrong.
Well, the other thing that I would hang my hat on are the federal courts that have looked at this. And there is an alternative way of getting a medicine approved by not going through the FDA process. I believe there's five criteria that they look at that also that has been litigated. And marijuana in that particular case failed the test. And the aspects that it was litigated in there were put into this rescheduling argument that the DEA and FDA made. So marijuana has not met the legal test under the law, and under the federal law anyway, and either by the FDA or by those criteria. That was, I think it was a safe access case or something like that in the federal level. So you've got a lot of work to do to make the scientific evidence. You've put out a lot of false information about it. And look, I'm not opposed to anything being used as medicine, as long as it goes through the FDA. I'm a cancer survivor. I certainly understand cancer survivors. I've been through it.
Are you familiar with PubMed, David, the PubMed website?
I am familiar with PubMed. Yeah, PubMed.
Okay,
yes.
there's over 12,000 studies just on CBD alone. And there's more every day, and so it's the science just needs to catch up to the negative politics that have kept this particular plant in the dark. And
well, if the studies that have been done on CBD, the FDA has done the most comprehensive one by getting Epidiolex approved, and that was, you know the FDA process. They go through thousands of tests and so forth, and things have to be validated. The company that did it is a reliable company. I've known them for years, GW Pharmaceuticals. They're credible, reliable. They did it right. They did the science right. If you look at the clinical trials, though, the websites on clinical trials, you will see that the cannabis products aren't getting through the clinical trials. Now, it's possible to get through there, because GW Pharmaceuticals did it. But the other studies haven't met the test. And if it was so good, there'd be a lot of other companies getting those clinical trials approved, and they're not.
Well, it's going to take time. But, you know, even with Epidiolex, there is a synthetic process to Epidiolex to give it consistency batch after batch. And so it does remove, some of the cannabinoids, terpenes, and flavonoids that would naturally be occurring in the plant. Now, I'm not saying Epidiolex isn't a great win for the industry, but at $32,000 a year, and most PBMs won't cover it until, the child has taken, some other drugs first. I mean, that's very painful for the parents, and also very deleterious for the child. They have to go through that before they can get Epidiolex. And then I've had parents who have said, when Epidiolex was approved 2 years ago, that, hey, this is great, but my kid needs a measure of THC along with CBD to control his seizures or her seizures. And so, it's not the silver bullet. It's certainly another tool in the doctor's belt, but it's not the silver bullet that, it could be if it was whole plant, completely whole plant with some THC.
Well, that remains to be proven. And the poster child for all this was Charlotte, who had seizures. And I'm sure you're aware that she recently just died of a seizure, and she was under the care of medical marijuana.
COVID, I think, had an impact on that, which is unfortunate.
No, her mother came out with a statement saying that it was not as a result of COVID. Her mother came out with a public statement saying that. And as long as you're bringing up COVID, I hope that you're recommending to patients that they not use marijuana, because it makes them more vulnerable to COVID. Marijuana has an immunosuppressant quality to it. Harvard Medical School did research on people with AIDS and found that people who use marijuana in any form moved into full-blown AIDS. These people had HIV moved to full-blown AIDS faster than other people did, because it hurt their immune system. It irritates lungs. And yet we've had difficulty, and yet we've had states declaring marijuana dispensaries that are actually contributing to COVID dangers, declared to be essential businesses that have to stay open. Now, the governor of Massachusetts had the courage to close the recreational ones. That was recently just upheld by the court. So I just hope that you're warning people about this. It's malpractice not to warn people about the dangers of a product. We represent the victims of marijuana. We can give you case after case after case. People who have been damaged by this, including medical marijuana users, people who have developed mental illness, committed suicide. And the factor was that they were using medical marijuana. I'm looking at a photograph right now of an Army airborne soldier who started using medical marijuana, wound up committing suicide, and mentioned marijuana in a suicide note. You know what the number one drug now is found in kids in Colorado who commit suicide, who are between the ages of 10 and 19? It's marijuana.
You know, David, I listened to a debate between on the Joe Rogan show between Alex Berenson and Dr. Michael Hart, who's a Canadian physician, and they talked about just that very topic. You know, the increase in teen female suicides. And Dr. Hart actually brought up a very good point that in this age of social media and bullying, you know, a lot of these girls, you know, are committing suicide, and you can't really blame it completely on marijuana use.
Well, no, the only statement that I made was that marijuana is the number one drug found in the dead bodies. More marijuana is found in the dead bodies of kids that commit suicide between the ages of 10 and 19 than any other drug, including alcohol.
Okay, it could be there, but you know, Brad, I think you say it very well. What's your comment, Brad?
Well, and speaking from a poison control aspect here, I would agree with you that there is marijuana in the serum, in detectable in a lot of the children, the people that are actually coming in that we're getting calls about that are reported suicide attempts. But is it the causative agent for increased hospital stay? Is it the causative agent for increased need for medical attention? Even in my experience in the emergency department and looking at length of stay and acuity based on the amount of resources that will be needed to serve a patient, it's rarely the marijuana that's causing it. It's usually co-ingestants.
And in addition, David, you know, your comment about Charlotte, Fiji, you know, the parents believe that the cause is most likely complications related to COVID. So, you know, and I'm not going to argue this point, but, you know, I don't believe that it was just based on CBD no longer working for her.
I didn't say it was. I was just pointing out that she died and her mother issued a statement saying it wasn't COVID. And now that we're talking about poison control, did you know that the rate of marijuana exposures among children under the age of 6 increased by 610% in the medical marijuana states? This is a study published in Clinical Pediatrics. And 75% of the children ingested edible marijuana products, such as marijuana-infused candy, and they wound up going to the ERs. Because of that. So what are you warning people about that when you sell your products?
And this goes back to your point about pharmacists not making a difference whether or not they're dispensing it or not. And I think that you're missing a key point that when patients come into a dispensary and they're counseled by a pharmacist, they get extensive education on appropriate use of the medication. And that's what we're very proud of, is presenting this in a medical fashion. In fact, states like Pennsylvania, as well as Minnesota, and I believe in Ohio as well, have been mandated by the governing agencies within that state.
Actually, Ohio hasn't mandated it. It's under the Board of Pharmacy, but Louisiana has. There's a number of states that have a pharmacist mandate.
What I'm getting at, though, is that they have been told not to have dosage forms that would appeal to children. Other states like California and Colorado will have dosage forms that unfortunately can be confused by pediatrics and by minors for other types of medication or for candy. But the states that are mandating appropriate use of certain and descript dosage forms, the whole point is trying to make sure that it is used by the appropriate parties.
Well, then you ought to change the name of the products that you're selling. I mean, want a store gummy strawberry? It looks like a candy. And yet there was a Mr. Jeffers from the Jeffries. That's one of the products that he sells. Why don't you put it up in a medicine-looking container so kids don't get it confused?
Dave, please speak to what you know. You know, again, Juanus is a one national brand of gummies, and it's in a child-proof container.
Well, it still could be attractive to a kid.
But we put a notice in every bag that says, look, keep this out of reach of children. Same way we do, same way I did when I worked in a pharmacy. You know,
well,
it's in a childproof container and keep out of reach.
Put it in something that a kid would understand, that it's a medical container. I'm looking at photographs of these containers. They don't look very medical to me. Your kiwi dragon fruit.
All I can say, Dave, is why do you have to
put that name?
Come to the dispensary and I'll show you one of the containers, or better yet, I'll send you one and you try to open it.
And what about BR milk chocolate bars?
Yeah, I think what we can do is open it up.
I think, guys, what we can all agree on is there are some states that are doing this right, and there are some states that are not. And
when I say it again. I do not agree with that. I don't think any state is doing it right.
Okay. Okay. Well, we disagree on that. And one thing that I wanted to do when I opened my dispensary was to not have these funky names for the products, but that's the nomenclature. Now, if you look at Israel, Israel has pharmaceutical grade cannabis that dispensed by pharmacies, and there's no funky names. It's the contents of the, you know, CBD, THC, or whatever else is in there, and that's how they dispense it. We will eventually get there, but we're not there yet.
Well, I hope you show some leadership in that regard. And if there is a dispensary that's selling gummies in brightly colored containers or chocolate bars, that I think that you should bring it up to your pharmacy association, ask them to stop doing it. Because if you don't do it, the lawyers are going to make you do it. And you're exposing yourself. I mean, people look at these products, and you go into court with a container called Kiwi strawberry gummies or something like that, and some kid got poisoned by it. You're going to have a lot of difficulty with the jury saying that you were responsible.
So we're going to be wrapping it up pretty soon, but we do want final statements. Joe Jeffries, you will go first. Thank you.
Sure. I appreciate that, Todd. Thank you. And Dave, I do appreciate you being here to express your side of the coin. But, you know, I also, what bothers me is that your website and you yourself can make accusations and anecdotes and use euphemisms and hyperbole when it comes to marijuana. You know, dope, weed, smoke weed, magic sticks. You know, you might talk about this as a punchline, but have the decency to acknowledge and respect the patients this medication has helped, anecdotally or not. And those gummies that you spoke of so harshly, you know, one happens to be an indica gummy that generally helps people sleep. I just had a patient that has suffered from sleep issues for a number of years, and I was pleased to hear that upon finding the right dose, it took a few days, he slept for the first time in really over a decade for more than just a couple hours. So these medicines do work. I think we're dispensing them appropriately. And I appreciate the time, Todd.
Dr. Carlson.
Again, I appreciate the opportunity to have a jam session with you gentlemen this afternoon. And I guess I'd like to just say that, you know, it was a pretty big risk for me to leave my lucrative field of emergency medicine to go into medical cannabis. I was nervous, but also too, I was looking at a good percentage of the people that I was serving in the emergency department who were coming into the ER, not to get drugs, but because of drugs. And I looked at the opportunity that medical cannabis would provide based on my firm belief in the oath of a pharmacist, which includes, I will embrace and advocate change in the profession of pharmacy that improves patients' care. And I was acutely aware of my ability to put my license on the line when I joined forces to help launch Leafline. But as soon as I started seeing patients in the dispensary and we were doing this the right way, educating them on appropriate use of medication, educating them on the dosage forms, and guiding them through every step of their process, and seeing the results on the other side, that they're able to finally get relief in some of their symptoms, that they're finally able to taper off some of their more detrimental pharmaceuticals, that I would do it again in a heartbeat, jeopardizing my license to be a leader in the opportunity to give this medication some opportunity to speak for itself. And everybody's going to have a little bit of differing opinion when it comes to this, because it's having a dual identity between recreation and medicinal use. But the fact of the matter is that if you do step in a dispensary that is dispensing medically to patients, you will undoubtedly see that lives are being improved, and not at the detriment that a lot of opposition would suggest. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Mr. David Evans, thank you for joining us. Your closing comments.
Yeah, my closing comments are, I want you to think of yourself in being in court a year or two from now when you have recommended a cannabis medicine to somebody, and the plaintiff's lawyer asks you, sir, can you tell us why you recommended lemon skunk or screaming eagle to this patient or kiwi dragon fruit gummies? So think about that. And the damage that marijuana has caused is not public knowledge yet. It is going to become public knowledge. And once it does, there's going to be a reckoning for all these folks that are seeing all this. You're not seeing all the damage that marijuana causes. You have your licenses to think about. You've got your patients to think about. You have your integrity to think about. I would look at what the FDA says. I would look at what's on our website. Every single thing that I have quoted here is documented, and there is a site for it. You can read and become educated yourself. Thank you very much.
Joseph Freeman, take us away.
Thank you, everybody, for attending. Joe Jeffries, Bradley Carlson. David, I appreciate your views on things. I have a very firm understanding and belief that, you know, any opposition group out there is cherry-picking information that comes from areas where it you can go ahead and take the data and come up with whatever final information you want. You know, saying that this is going to be a gateway and lead to a lot of opioid deaths. I actually consider cannabis an exit drug, and I have a lot of cases with patients that have done that. So, you know, to go ahead and predict that there's going to be a lot of issues in the future and a lot of lawsuits, you know, not that, you know, I'm not trying to say that you're an ambulance chaser, but I think this is an opportunity to go ahead with the idea that this is going to happen, and then you're going to be disappointed in the future when this doesn't happen.
Yes, I want to thank our guests today. I want to thank David Evans and Joe Jeffries. I have to come up and see you at the East Liverpool location. Dr. Bradley Carlson, really appreciate being a part of the medical cannabis debate part two. We will be scheduling a part three, so please stay tuned. Please share these podcasts. You'll be able to reach out via email to our guests with any follow-up further questions. And as always, I thank you for listening to the Pharmacy Podcast.